The headlines: Iran imposes sanctions on several Canadian individuals and an entity for supporting anti-Iran terrorist groups and inciting violence. Fresh escalation in the occupied West Bank, where Israeli forces shoot dead a Palestinian alleging he attacked a group of officers with a knife. And South Korea and the U.S. extend their massive air drills in response to the North firing a long-range ballistic missile. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran says it has imposed sanctions on a number of Canadian individuals and an entity over their support for terrorist groups and inciting violence against Iranians. The foreign ministry said sanctioned individuals and entity have supported anti-Iran MKO terrorist group and spread false information about the country. It said they also played a key role in imposing brutal sanctions on the Iranian people. The sanctions list includes Canada's National Defense Minister, the Chief Justice, the Chief of the Defense Staff, and the commanders of Canadian Air Force and Navy. The National Post newspaper has also been blacklisted because of its anti-Iran positions, a ban on issuing visas, and entry into Iran, as well as seizure of their properties within the Islamic Republic's territory, are among punishments considered for the sanctioned individuals and entity. Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan traveled to Iran this week on an official visit aimed at expanding bilateral ties. Speaking at a joint press of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi said peace and stability in the Caucasus is of great significance to the Islamic Republic and that any foreign interference in the affairs of the rest of the region will only complicate the situation.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan has held high-level talks in Tehran following a trilateral meeting with Russian and Azerbaijani leaders on the conflict in the Caucasus region. He was officially received by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi on Tuesday morning, and the two held talks at the Sarabat Palace in the capital, Tehran. In addition to a bilateral meeting, the two top executive officials held a meeting of high-level delegations, and after attending the signing ceremony of a cooperation document in the field of energy, they elaborated on the results of their consultations in a joint press conference. The Iranian president stated that Pashinyan's visit to Iran will be a turning point in the development of ties between the two neighboring countries.
Neighborhood policy is one of the policies emphasized by the government, and during this administration we had several meetings with Mr. Pashinyan. In these meetings, especially in this particular meeting, the focus of the negotiations was the development of commercial, economic and security relations between the two countries.
Expressing satisfaction with the growing trends of relations between the two countries, Raisi pointed to the diverse and numerous capacities available in Iran and Armenia, calling for an all-out effort to improve the level of relations and expand bilateral cooperation. The Iranian president pointed to energy cooperation as one of the capacities available to improve the level of relations between the two countries, saying, "The Islamic Republic is ready to expand cooperation in other economic and commercial areas, including in increasing the export of technical and engineering services." Also noting that the Caucasus region is a part of Iran's history, civilization and culture, Raisi underscored that security and peace in the Caucasus region are very important for Iran. The Iranian president added that negotiations with Pashinyan led to the conclusion that resolving the issues of the region must occur at the hands of officials and authorities of the region, and any interference by foreigners will only create problems rather than solve them. Pashinyan, for his part, appreciated the constructive role of the Islamic Republic in the region and stressed that Iran's efforts have always been aimed at stabilizing and strengthening peace and security in the region. Pashinyan expressed gratitude for the priority given by Raisi's administration to the development of ties with the neighboring countries. The Armenian premier also called for strengthening transit cooperation between the two countries to connect the Black Sea to the Persian Gulf.
Pashinyan's visit to Tehran comes on the heels of a trip by the Iranian foreign minister to Armenia. During the October visit, Amir Abdullahian opened an Iranian consulate general in Armenia's southernmost city of Kapan near the Iranian border. The latest diplomatic efforts by Tehran are aimed at securing the country's national interests.
Iran opened a consulate in the southern Armenian city of Kapan on October 21st, nearly a year after expressing interest in doing so. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian officially inaugurated the consulate. At the opening ceremony, Amir Abdullahian stated that the security of Armenia and the region is Iran's security. He called for the development of north-south transportation corridor through Armenia. He also said Tehran's policies to respect territorial integrity as well as internationally recognized borders. Tehran had previously stated that changes in its borders and transit links with Armenia would be a red line that it would not tolerate being crossed. That's when Turkey and Azerbaijan have been planning to establish a new transport link called the Zangzur Corridor. In case of opening, it will affect Iran-Armenia commerce and could sever a major Iranian transit link with the South Caucasus. Meanwhile, Tehran has not contented itself with only diplomatic messages. The inauguration of the Kapan Consulate came after several days of large-scale military exercises by IRGC near Iran's borders with Azerbaijan. The latest simultaneous diplomatic and defensive moves clearly show the Iranian government is ready to defend its national interests in all seriousness.
There's been another deadly confrontation in the occupied West Bank where Israeli forces killed yet another young Palestinian. Hours ago, the military says Israeli forces shot dead 20-year-old Badr Amer in Al-Quds, alleging that he attacked a group of officers with a knife. Israeli media reporting that three officers have been lightly injured in the stabbing. Separately, Israeli soldiers shot dead a 42-year-old man identified as Mahmoud Rayan. It happened overnight when the military raided the village of Beit Dahu in northwestern Al-Quds. Israel has recently tightened its deadly grip on the occupied West Bank and widened its crackdown on Palestinians there. Nearly 140 Palestinians have lost their lives in the West Bank this year alone. From Ramallah, Muna Kandil has the details about the latest Israeli attacks on Palestinians.
In less than 48 hours, two Palestinians from the village of Beit Dahu, northwest Al-Quds, had been killed by the Israeli forces yesterday at one of the Israeli military checkpoints, Beit Awan, a checkpoint. A Palestinian man, 54 years old, Habas Rayan, was shot by the Israeli soldiers and was killed. This morning, the Israeli troops raided the hometown of Rayan, who was killed yesterday, in order to arrest Palestinians and family members of Rayan. Clashes took place between the Palestinian residents of the town of Beit Dahu and the Israeli soldiers. Israeli soldiers used their arms and using, of course, live rounds against the Palestinians. There, three Israeli police officers were wounded, one of them from stabbing, and let's say two others, or at least one from a shrapnel by the Israeli fire. We are speaking about the 20-year-old Amer Badr Halbiya from Beit Hanina town in Al-Quds. He was shot dead by the Israeli forces, as you have mentioned, in the old town of Al-Quds. All the entrances to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the old town of Al-Quds were completely sealed off by the Israeli forces. More Israeli police officers were sent to the old town of Al-Quds.
South Korea says the neighboring North has launched three ballistic missiles earlier today as tensions are reaching a new peak on the Korean Peninsula.
This morning, our military detected the firing of one long-range ballistic missile from Sunan area in Pyongyang toward the East Sea, and two short-range ballistic missiles from Kaechon in South Pyongyang province toward the East Sea.
The South Korean official also said that Seoul will respond to any provocation from Pyongyang while tracking any movements in the north in close cooperation with the U.S. According to the South Korean military, the intercontinental ballistic missile that the North launched on Thursday likely failed in its flight. Japan has also confirmed the launches, saying that it had to issue evacuation alerts in some northern regions. Just today, earlier, Pyongyang fired at least 23 missiles, the highest number in a single day. The launches are in response to Seoul and Washington conducting their largest ever joint air drills involving hundreds of warplanes from both sides. The two sides now say that they've agreed to extend their exercises. Following North Korea's ICBM launch, Pyongyang views the drills as an aggressive and existential threat.
The U.S. and South Korea Monday began their largest joint Air Force exercises ever, with 240 planes participating. North Korea warned the U.S. about the drills, which it views as a rehearsal for invasion. Pyongyang Wednesday launched more than 20 ballistic missiles, with one missile landing south of the maritime border, says South Korea's military.
Since 8:51 a.m. today, North Korea launched three ballistic missiles and one of them landed in the East Sea, south of the NLL. Today's launch is the first time a North Korean missile landed near our territorial waters, south of the NLL, and this is unprecedented and unacceptable. Our military will respond sternly to this act.
South Korea then launched three guided missiles from jet fighter aircraft toward the northern side of the eastern sea border. Japan also reacted to North Korea's missile firing.
North Korea has been repeatedly firing missiles at an unprecedented pace, and it's absolutely impermissible. Given the heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula, I would like to convene a National Security Council as soon as possible.
The security atmosphere surrounding the Korean Peninsula has been steadily deteriorating since conservative South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol came to power in May, promising to strengthen the alliance with the U.S. and take a hard line with North Korea. In late summer, U.S. and South Korea held the largest land-based military exercises since 2017. During a previous South Korean missile launch in response to North Korean missile testing, one South Korean missile was lost. Another landed 700 meters from a residential area, causing a fire. This demonstrates the inherent risk of this missile testing and joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises that could lead to an accident or miscalculation and potentially armed conflict. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Well, here's our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, shedding more light on the latest missile launch by North Korea. Let's have a listen.
North Korea is always testing missiles, and eventually, in the near future, it's going to successfully test this missile. Many experts have been predicting they are going to fire the ICBM before the U.S. midterm elections next Tuesday, because North Korea wants the U.S. to realize that it is not going to back down against the pressure of the U.S.-South Korea military exercises. And these experts say that North Korea will then follow up with this ICBM test by conducting a nuclear test, its seventh nuclear test and its first nuclear test since 2017. So the pressure is unrelenting, but the U.S. and South Korea, even though the odds are stacked up against them, they have nothing else to do except just keep doing this U.S.-South Korea military drill, this string of them that they have been doing. And this may be causing North Korea to just get more angry. It looks like it, and it also looks like it's increasing the risk of an accidental war breaking out here on the Korean Peninsula.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that Moscow may leave the Ukraine grain deal again if Kiev violates its security guarantees.
Russia retains the right to leave these agreements if these guarantees from Ukraine are violated.
Putin said if Russia withdrew from the deal, it would continue to supply the entire grain delivered from Ukraine to the poorest countries free of charge. Putin's warning came after Russia resumed its participation in the UN-brokered Ukraine grain delivery deal earlier on Wednesday. Moscow said it had received written security guarantees from Kiev to demilitarize the maritime corridor. Russia suspended the implementation of the deal on Saturday over a drone attack on its Black Sea fleet in Crimea. Russia blamed Ukraine for the attack, but Kiev dismissed Moscow's claim as a false pretext for suspending the deal. As Islamophobia Awareness Month gets underway, the UK government has decided to ditch plans to find a working definition of Islamophobia which it can adopt. British Muslims remain one of the biggest victims of hate crimes in Britain, according to statistics, yet the ruling party believes any definition would be a danger towards freedom of speech. Robert Carter reports from London.
The UK government has abandoned plans to create a working definition of Islamophobia in a move which has come under heavy fire from critics. Back in May 2019, the then government headed by Theresa May agreed it would seek to establish an Islamophobia definition to get a firmer grip of this bigotry and division. But following mounting frustration over a lack of progress on the issue, the effort has now been reportedly ditched.
The news is hardly surprising, as May's successor, Boris Johnson, has been faulted many times over for saying Islamophobic things, whilst other Tory ministers have also been accused of being deeply Islamophobic themselves.
Reappointed Communities Secretary Michael Gove has been a long-time critic of so-called political Islam and condemned attempts to define Islamophobia as a danger for free speech.
Michael Gove, while he was at Policy Exchange, was very much supportive of anything which, as far as he was concerned, outed Islam. He calls it political Islam. But actually, in reality, it's a phobia which these folk have about any kind of Muslim. When you look at and compare it to how they deal with anti-Semitism, and they're so absolutely hell-bent on definitions, on laws, on rooting out, on chasing, hunting down, witch-hunting anybody who even sniffs the idea of something to do with Jewry, or even say the J word, or even to raise the issue of Zionism, for instance, or to criticize Israel. As soon as you do these things, as far as these neoconservatives are concerned, you are enemy number one.
Islamophobia is a serious problem across Britain. Muslims being the most frequently targeted group for religious hate crimes in England and Wales. Defining Islamophobia could provide new powers to combat anti-Muslim hate. But with a string of scandals having exposed anti-Muslim bigotry within the ruling party itself, Conservatives just don't seem willing to risk shooting themselves in the foot on the issue. Robert Carter, London.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hidden Files.
Punish for the original sin, and that is beating white supremacy colonialism. That is how some experts describe what has happened and continues to happen to a small but significant nation in the Caribbean, Haiti. Slavery in Haiti began after the arrival of Christopher Columbus on the island in 1492 with European colonists that followed from Portugal, Spain, and France. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was once called, the French had enslaved 500,000 Africans there. Well, the slaves would harvest coffee, sugarcane, and work the cotton fields and serve the Europeans in whatever ways the colonialists deemed necessary. This island became France's most lucrative possession. Ultimately, the slaves who were treated terribly started revolting against the French. Now, this movement ultimately led to their victory over the imperialist colonialists, and Haiti became the only country in the world where former slaves succeeded in overthrowing their enslavers and establishing their own country. These Africans were able to beat one of the best militaries at the time that was led by Napoleon. He sent 50,000 French troops to the island, but ultimately France and their European and American supporters lost. This is the original sin, that Africans were successful in beating European colonizers. And some analysts say the American-European front has never forgiven Haiti for winning and for being black. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Haiti set an example when it declared its independence in 1804. It became the first country in the world to permanently outlaw slavery and ban imperial rule during a time when slavery was the norm in many countries. Haiti was the symbol of freedom. Haiti broke the common rule of the day that liberty and equality were for white men only. Haiti said that no human beings should ever be enslaved. It sounds very enlightening, but that is not how the French, the Americans, and others saw it. Leaders wanted to do whatever they could in order for Haiti not to succeed. And those who revolted in Haiti wanted to do whatever they could in order for the revolution to succeed.
U.S. President Thomas Jefferson was worried that the revolution in Haiti could ignite a slave revolt in the United States, and he would do his best not to help Haiti's southern slaveholders, who were very fearful that this could spread and encourage U.S. politicians to overthrow the new country. Napoleon Bonaparte, French military leader at the time, wrote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever the forward march of blacks in the world." After Haiti had routed the French and its allies, the first leader of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said about the victory, "These impeccable enemies of the rights of man have been punished for their crimes. Yes, we have paid these true cannibals back, crime for crime, war for war, outrage for outrage. I have saved my country. I have avenged America."
Well, when listening to the story of Haiti, it sounds like a part of history that took place a long time ago in the past. But the reality is that as we bring you this program today, the Haitian people are on the streets and have been for months. The people are demanding an end to foreign intervention and the theft of their wealth. They want the United Nations not to interfere, and they want these Western and so-called international entities to stop impoverishing Haiti and to stop trying to enslave this nation once again. Well, to help me look at this further, I'd like to turn to our guest, Dr. Jemima Pierre.
Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American Studies and Anthropology. Currently, she teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. She is the coordinator of the Haiti Americas team, Black Alliance for Peace, and editor and contributor for the Black Agenda Report.
Well, Dr. Pierre, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. You know, whenever we hear anything about Haiti, it is always negative and the country's demonized. In your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a great quote by the African-American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, who says that Haiti has never been forgiven for winning the revolution against slavery and colonialism. And so we have to start there. We have to start thinking about it's 200 and some years of constant demonization, constant move to suppress Haitian self-determination. And so from the very beginning, so people should know that, for example, you know, Haiti became independent in 1804. The U.S. and the West did not really recognize Haitian independence until 1865. And so it's been hard going ever since then, trying to maintain sovereignty and independence. And the West, I think, really has a has this really deep hatred for that history because it did upend the entire system of slavery and colonization in the New World.
Well, I mean, what would you say to some people that, you know, that happened over 200 years ago? Why would they still try to punish Haiti today?
Well, it is interesting, right, to say that for such a country that, for a country that is so small, and for a country that seems insignificant, the U.S. really spends a lot of time and money trying to control it. And so we have to think about, for example, the fact that even after independence, what you had was constant affronts by the French, by the British, but by the U.S. So the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which is the longest, one of the longest occupations in the region, very brutal. In fact, the U.S. practice its first aerial bombing campaigns in Haiti during that occupation. The U.S. has the fourth largest embassy in Haiti. And you have to, so you're saying, well, if Haiti's so inconsequential, why does it have the fourth largest embassy? Why in 2003 did France, U.S., and Canada meet in Ottawa? It's, if you, your listeners can look up the Ottawa Initiative, met in Ottawa, basically coming up with a plan to remove the democratically elected president of Haiti, which plan succeeded in February 2004. The year of the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence. And so there's a lot of history that demonstrates that there's this really deep, deep set of feelings among the Europeans for Haiti. And the way that Haiti is demonized and talked about in the news, the way that things are sensationalized. And so, you know, we in the U.S., where I am currently living, we have mass shootings every day. You know, the schools are in lockdown. This is a very violent country, but it doesn't get represented in the same way that Haiti does if we have a set of protests, set of protesters. So there's a built-up history of representations of Haiti that allow the world to actually believe that these black people are savages that cannot run themselves. And, you know, the one quote that I wanted to show is, you know, Napoleon, whose army, which at the time was the most powerful army in the day, was defeated by the Haitians. And he wrote, and I have this quote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue," which is what Haiti was called, "is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever forward the march of the blacks of the world, in the world." And so if you start with that quote, what does that tell you about the feelings towards Haiti? And I think if you see that and then you see all the WikiLeaks files which were released and you see the machinations behind U.S. policy in Haiti, then everything comes clear to us. In the Security Council meetings, everyone was saying we need an intervention because there's gang violence. And so then you had the representatives from Albania, of all places, which is like at the edge of Europe and going through its own problems. It's going to have its own security, energy crisis in a couple of months. And then you have Ireland, which is barely independent, and you have Kenya. And all these people are calling for intervention because they're saying we need to deal with gang violence. What's interesting is that what doesn't come up, especially for the Latin American countries, is that Haiti is under occupation, right? And that's what I want the world to know. In 2004, when the U.S. led coup d'etat that removed the president, put him on a plane, the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane and flew him to Africa into exile, of all places. And then the U.S. sent the military, U.S., Canada, and France had military folks already on the ground within hours of this removal. And then they were able to get the UN to cover up this by sending in a Chapter 7 deployment of UN peacekeeping. And what you have then is you have this brutal force that was there, you know, with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, a whole apparatus. The way they were able to hide this occupation, because they were able to get a multiracial, multinational force, UN forces, to say that they're stabilizing Haiti. Haiti was not at war. So a Chapter 7 deployment means that they could use force. And the UN, which we call the occupation forces, killed thousands of people. They brought cholera into the country that killed 30,000 people because they dumped feces, you know, fecal matter in Haiti, the main water source in central Haiti. It sickened a million people, killed more than 30,000 people. The UN, it took them 6 years to at least acknowledge that it was their fault. And so you have that. But under this occupation, you had the construction of what they call the core group. And this core group was founded in 2004, right when the UN Security Council resolution said that the force was coming. And the core group the membership has fluctuated, but it has members from Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the U.S., the European Union, the Organization of American States. And they basically coordinate the various branches of the United Nations occupation of Haiti. The core group still runs Haiti.
Wow, it's really something unbelievable. I mean, if we look back at 2003 that you just talked about, with the election of the Haitian president, President Aristide, and he demanded France after he was elected to repay Haiti $21 billion in reparations. Now, he was removed in a Western-backed coup the next year, as you had just talked about. Do you think that there is a direct correlation between the Haitian president demanding reparation and him basically being overthrown?
Oh, definitely. You know, he said that, and I think it really riled up the French, the Canadians, and the Americans, and the French in particular. And the French have a really terrible colonial role. I mean, look what they did in, you know, in Libya and Algeria and all over West Africa till this day, right? They're stealing all their resources and so on. But that was really, you know, he made that speech the year before in 2003. And by the end of 2003, you have France, Canada, and the U.S. meeting in Ottawa, coming up with a plan. And one of the first things they did were when they removed him, and I actually have an article that is called The Archive of Occupation, which lays out minute day by day how this coup d'etat happened from 2000, you know, from all of early 2004. And what you see is as soon as they find this guy that they bring in and they make him, you know, interim prime minister. So they remove Aristide, they bring him. And the first thing he does was remove the petition, the request for the reparations, right? So that was one of the first acts. And so that tells me there's definitely a direct connection. And I think, you know, ever since then, you know, people have picked up on that. So for example, the New York Times had a whole story on reparations, but what's not included in that story is the fact that Haiti's under current occupation now. And people want to forget that there's an occupation going, that there's no sovereignty in the country. But I do think it's very much linked to the request for this payment back. That you have this coup d'etat. I mean, to be fair, not to be fair, but Aristide was already, that was the second coup against Aristide. The CIA was behind a coup of Aristide in 1991, 9 months after he was elected by landslide, after we had 30 years of a U.S.-supported dictatorship. And so they've been after him, but this particular time, I think this played a big role in having him removed.
Well, stay with us, Dr. Pierre. You have a lot of information. I'll be back right after this with you.
A country with 10 million people, which shares the island with the Dominican Republic. Haiti is a country which has never been forgiven by Western imperialists for its revolution in 1803, where slaves beat them all and declared its independence. It took France until 1825 to recognize Haiti's independence, and this came only after Paris sent 12 warships and threatened Haiti to repay France for its lost revenue and property, meaning the slaves and their labor. Up until that time, no country would trade with Haiti. The French demanded the astronomical amount of 150 million gold francs. It took Haiti until 1947 to pay this crippling debt. This prevented Haiti from having funds to invest in its own country. Because of financial pressure to pay France, Haiti got a loan from the United States. In 1914, the U.S. sent soldiers to collect what they called the debt, invaded Haiti, and went directly to Haiti's national bank and walked out with $500,000 in gold, packed in wooden boxes. The gold was in the vault of a Wall Street bank within days. The U.S. then occupied Haiti for 19 years and left in name in 1934. Since that time, there has been coups, assassinations, and interference by Western governments, as well as international organizations. In 2003, the president of Haiti at the time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, demanded that France repay Haiti for the gold francs that Paris had extorted from the country. He said that amount would now come to $21 billion. The following year, Aristide was overthrown in a coup and flown to the Central African Republic by the Americans. After the coup, the United Nations sent in troops who would remain there for 13 years, leaving a legacy of death via cholera and insecurity. 2021, President Jovenel Moïse is assassinated. 2022, currently Haiti is not being run by an elected president, but a group picked by the international community, who many would say prioritize the needs of Western countries and corporations, not the Haitian people. Currently, Haitians are on the street, and the IMF is trying to force the government to take away gasoline subsidies that would pressure the people even more.
Well, let's get back to our guest, Dr. Pierre, now. Dr. Pierre, give me a little short history of the damage you feel that's been done to Haiti by colonialism and the colonialists.
To win this independence, Haiti had to fight against the French, the Spanish, the British, the Americans. It's like they were all helping each other. And so if you ever visit Citadel in Haiti, where, you know, it's built at the top, you can see all the cannons that they had acquired from the various European forces that were fighting them. And so that tells you that from the very beginning. But the other part is, it is, you know, the French, of course, you know, it's the gold franc that it took, which really impoverished the country, because then in order, and the leader at the time felt that he needed to do that in order to get recognition, right? This was a country that had to fight a scorched earth war against this superpower, and they were enslaved Africans with no weapons, right? And they were able to win. And so by the end of this, there's nothing left, you know, on the ground, and they have to start from scratch. But no one would no other nation would recognize them, right, for a long time. And so this president thought that maybe, you know, if they go ahead and pay France, that they would get the recognition so that you can have trade and so on and so forth. But then in paying that, it just meant that it was, you're impoverishing the country, because, you know, it got so bad, and then they had to get a loan from the U.S. to pay off the French. And so they didn't finish paying that till very recently, right? So you can see what this means in terms of paying a debt for your own freedom, right? To paying the European, paying your former enslavers money because you dare be free. The U.S. is very... The U.S. is very much implicated in this. And I do think the Europeans work together. And so I call it, like, you know, pan-European, like, white supremacy, because they do work together. But the U.S., you know, the first thing with the French is the image of Haiti that emerges out of this period, right? So you have a brutal uprising, but they're representing it in the media, in the Western media in the 1800s, as these savages are killing white landowners, raping white women. And so if you look at the images from the early 1800s, that's what you see of Haiti, that these are like violent savages that can't stay that can't really rule themselves. And that image has really followed us over the years. So even if you, it was like, you know, if there was a shooting and two people got killed, it becomes huge, as opposed to the mass shootings we have in the U.S. every day, right? It doesn't make the news. And part of that is already baked into the worldview, including other countries outside of Europe, because that's the images that they're fed.
What needs to happen, in your opinion, to turn the situation around in Haiti?
It is complex. And I do talk about this, that people think, oh, Haiti is so difficult, so complex, and we don't know what to do. It's actually not that complex. What Haitians want is the UN to get out of their country. The UN is not, you know, the UN is not a democratic institution. It has five core members that make all the decisions, and the five core members are mostly from the West. You know, they finally opened it up to China and Russia. But the UN is not a democratic institution, and we are under occupation. So the Haitian people want the U.S., the UN to get out. They want the U.S. to remove, take down this puppet prime minister that they put in place that they don't want, because it's under this puppet prime minister that's allowing all of these things to happen. And I have to say, there's illegal mining going on in Haiti. These puppet governments have basically signed over all of Haiti's mineral resources, and the country's rich with mineral resources. There are oil companies drilling right on the outside, on the outskirts of the island. And so we have to think about the fact that if Haiti is so poor, why is it that every day there are like four flights from Miami, Florida to Haiti filled with white businessmen going to Haiti to make money, right? So there's that. And so what Haitians want is they want this so-called, this prime minister that's implicated, by the way, in the assassination of the president, right? And the U.S. knows that. The U.S. has all the evidence. They want the prime minister to come down. They want the UN to leave Haiti, and they want the space for Haitian, they always say this, Haitian solution. And, you know, before Jovenel Moïse was the president that was assassinated, before he was assassinated in July, there are a bunch of groups that came together in February 2021. And, you know, it was like a coalition for, you know, coming up with a Haitian solution. And there are several groups. One is called the Montana Group, that basically laid out a plan, a two-year plan for the transitional government, elections, and so on. Well, the U.S. refused to take heed. And not only did they refuse to take heed, they managed to actually, incorporate some of these individuals, right? Managed to get them so that they could basically follow through and then try to gain favor with the U.S. And so then that basically just took out all the active radical elements from the group. And basically the group just was destroyed. And so now the U.S. is talking about a Haitian solution, but it's handpicked. It has handpicked those who are supposed to come up with a Haitian solution. So what we need is to be left alone. These people need to leave us alone. They need to leave the country, leave us alone, and we will figure it out. And we're not even being allowed to do that. They won't leave. You know, they won't leave the country. They won't stop, you know, intervening. And until they do, it's going to be a mess. And I think at this point, Haitians have had it. And I think they're willing to continue protesting. And I have to also say, these current protests have been going on for 6 weeks, but you would never know that, right? Because you would never know that they've been protesting, asking the UN to leave.
Wow, really interesting. Dr. Pierre, do you have any final comments for our viewers?
Well, I just want to say, I hope people watching this will take the time and understand the situation is not an exceptional situation in the sense that Haiti is so different from the rest of us, the rest of the world who are suffering from Western imperialism. And so if we understand Haiti and Haitian people as real human beings, not just, you know, these people who won a revolution 200 years ago, real human beings with real needs and need to have access to their own sovereignty and their self-determination, I hope the rest of the world will join us in that fight against the Western imperialism that is really holding, you know, that is keeping us under their boot.
All right, and we hope the same thing. Thanks so much for being with us here on the program, Dr. Pierre. The story of Haiti is one of a country with so much potential, so many resources, but one which has been sabotaged. Many of its members of its upper class have worked in cahoots with Western governments to steal all they can and to create chaos on the island. The real story is the wealth that has been stolen that needs to be returned. This is another story of colonialists and imperialists being held responsible and made to repay what they've stolen, though they can never really repay it. It is estimated that currently France should repay at least $120 billion for the money that it extorted from Haiti. And then the United States should be held responsible for its theft and causing instability in Haiti. There are groups that are taking these demands for reparations to the international community, but will it make a difference? What we know is that the Haitian people are revolutionary and resilient, and we hope that while they are on the streets demanding justice, that this will ultimately lead to their real independence and empowerment. Well, like all of our other files we've mentioned, we will continue to follow up on Haiti, the affluent nation, which has been impoverished and demonized, with the hope that the Haitian people will ultimately get what they deserve. Until next time, I'm Marzia Hashimi for Hidden Files.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, the listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. one of the keys of life was to protect ourselves from harm, and specifically to protect ourselves from diseases. Now, alhamdulillah, the school of thought of the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam, we are blessed that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us 14 beautiful infallibles. And those infallibles, they've told us everything, everything that we need to know, be it about Allah, be it about this world, be it about people, or even how to become hygienic and healthy. I will read for you some of the ahadith of the Ahl Bayt to show you how much the Ahl Bayt have taken this matter seriously when it comes to hygiene and taking care of our body. We see that the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam, even when it comes to drinking water, they say, إِيَّاكَ وَشُرْبُ الْمَاءِ بَارِدًا. I warn you, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, to drink water cold. We love to drink cold water. We love to drink cold drinks. We love to drink all the food cold. If they're not cold, we're not going to drink them because they don't have a good taste. Well, the Ahl Bayt, they say, actually, on the contrary, do not drink them cold. So obviously, because they have bad effects on the stomach, on the intestines, or whatever the cold water goes through, sometimes has bad effects on your teeth. There are a lot of bad results and effects that comes from cold water. And even the Imam says, especially in the shower, if you're having a shower, do not drink cold water. Why, Ibn Rasulullah? He says, فَإِنَّهُ يُفْسُدُ الْمَعْدَ, for it will corrupt your abdominal, your stomach will be corrupted if you drink cold water, and especially in the bathroom. Again, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi says, أَلَا لَا يَسْتَلْقِيَنَّ أَحَدُكُمْ فِي الْحَمَّامِ, when you go to the shower, don't sleep and relax. Now, sadly, this is where we relax the most. We have a jacuzzi, and the jacuzzi's job is just to, you know, blow up bubbles and relaxes your muscle. And so it's a kind of sleep. But the Imam says, do not do that. Right? فَإِنَّهُ يُذِيبُ شَحْمَ الْكِلْيَتَيْنِ, laying in the shower, in the bath, he says it melts the fat of the kidneys. Obviously, the kidneys, they have their own functions, and they have whatever fat that they might require for themselves, for their functionality. The Imam says that melts it and causes it, obviously, to misfunction or functionless. Also, the Imam alayhi salam says, Amir al-Mu'mineen, when you have a shower and you're about to leave, he says, pour cold water on your feet. Why, ya Amir al-Mu'mineen? He says, فَإِنَّهُ يُسِيلُ الدَّاءَ مِنْ جَسَدِكَ, for it will remove all the disease from your body. Now, every time you have a shower and you finish, pour cold water from your knees down to your toes for 2, 3, 4 seconds. Wash them with cold water and walk out. That will give you a protection from disease, also by the words of the infallible himself. Let us take a break, then we continue right after.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فرم نماز و ثواب داره فرم روزه اون
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فرم درخت کاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره
امام has mentioned both of these subjects. The very imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این ثواب داره
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون. این هم همون امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. The Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, they're constantly teaching us how we can live a healthy life. And obviously a healthy life, it means a happier, prosperous life. And the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salamullah, they left no stone unturned. The Imam alayhi salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he gives an instruction to how a person should have a shower and what he should and should not do, among the things that he says, when you wear your clothes, you say, Allahumma albisni taqwa wa jannibni rada. O Allah, clothe me or garment me with piety and avoid me bad deeds and bad acts. The Imam alayhi salam, he says, if a person wearing his clothes says that dua, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will do what? He says, فَإِذَا فَعَلَ ذَلِكَ If he does so, أَمِنْتَ مِنْ كُلِّ دَاءَ You will be safe from every disease. Now, subhanallah, only two words that you ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to clothe you with piety and to avoid you from bad action. And Allah says that dua will take its effect on the physical body. So now me and you, we're constantly changing clothes in and out, wearing one garment and putting the other. So all you have to do is only three words, O Allah, clothe me with garment of taqwa and get away from me the garment of bad sins and bad actions. That's all there is to it. Also, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam and some other narrations, they say, when he come to the bathroom, wear an imam put on a turban, meaning cover your head. And the imam says, I will have not left putting a turban on my head every time I leave the hammam or the shower from winter and summer. So obviously these seasons, whatever happens that you need to take care of yourself and make sure that when you have a shower, make sure that you wrap your head with the towel or whatever, just so you don't get cold. The Imam, he himself says, every time I go to the bathroom, I have a shower. When I leave, I have a towel over my head or an imama, as they have it back in the day, and especially during summer and winter, because these are the seasons where one could get sick the most. So we see the Ahl Bayt alayhim salam. They go in that depth with us just to teach us. Al-Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, Al-Hammamu yawmun wa yawmun la. Some people, they have this habit of having a shower every day. Obviously, this is not healthy. The Imam says shower should be one day on, one day off. So if you have a shower today, tomorrow should be off, the day after you have a shower. Why? Because he says, Yukthur lahm. If you have that one on, one off, he says your body will grow. The meat in your body will grow. وَإِدْمَانُهُ فِي كُلِّ يَوْمٍ يُذِيبُ شَحْمَ الْكِلْيَتَيْنِ And if you overdo it, if you have a shower every day, that will melt the body, that will melt the fat, and it will melt your meat, and a person becomes a lot sicker and more anorexic. So we are told not to do so. Therefore, we get to say, as Muslims, we have been instructed to prevent harm to our bodies, whether it is food, whether it is having a shower, or anything in between. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents
a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.